You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 29th of May to the 4th of June. My name is John Elms, and today I'm joined by books editor Karen Shook, deputy features editor Paul Jump, and a reporter Jack Grove. And in our news this week, a Times Education survey has found that a number of UK universities spent nearly £20 million over 4 years settling employment disputes. Paul will have more on that splash later. London universities have advantages not found elsewhere in the UK, but also face unique challenges. Jack has the lowdown on the capital's progression to almost otherworldly status in UK higher education. And Karen will be rounding up this week's extremely varied book section, which includes our book of the week, The Drunken Monkey, Why We Drink and Abuse Alcohol.
You just want to say that, The Drunken Monkey. It's inherently funny.
It is fantastic. It was one of the best titles I've had to read out in these things. I have to admit, I did want to get it in there. Okay, but first, yes, Paul, your splash this week is based on a freedom of information request that you made to UK universities. What's your story? What's your story all about?
It is. I found myself recently at two employment tribunal hearings, both of which involved Imperial College, and I was just struck really while I was sitting there as to how much all of this was costing and lawyers' fees, particularly given the painfully slow progress of these cases. So I submitted an FOI request to about 125 universities to see, you know, how much money these things do actually cost. Somewhat thwarted by, certain universities refusing to release figures on various things for various reasons, some of which were more...
spurious?
Some of which were more convincing than others, let's say. Quite a few universities didn't respond at all either, which isn't unusual, sadly, with an FOI request. But anyway... we came up with the figure that of the 75 universities that actually gave us figures on their number of disputes, there were a bit over 1,300 actual employment disputes over the last 4 years. That's 2010 to 2013 inclusive. And of those, 210 actually resulted in a tribunal hearing. The total spending of about 70 universities that gave us figures was 18.6 million. So you can assume that, you know, the real figure of all universities is obviously significantly higher than that. Mm. Spending per case was about £15,000.
Yeah, I mean the average was 66,400 per institution per year, yeah. Which. The highest case I think it was incurred by Royal Holloway was 69,200, and you contacted a lot of people that you spoke to would suggest that the figures you gleaned, which by your own admission people not everyone has responded to them, so you can't fully claim what would be the total. Some people would say that actually more has been spent because. One quote from your story is that someone said that universities reporting the highest numbers might just be the most assiduous about classifying disputes.
Yeah, that's right. I should clarify that the Royal Holloway figure, that was for spending on lawyers rather than payouts.
That is true.
I asked about that as well. Even fewer universities gave figures on that. But again, we got a pretty high... total figure in excess of 10 million, and that's just on the external lawyers, never mind the internal ones and the HR staff. So, yeah, I mean, it's a significant figure. And a lawyer I spoke to for the article suggested that those kinds of figures were sort of relatively high compared to other employment sectors.
Hmm.
I wonder if the level of the number of disputes is related to the recent REF exercise where some people were being sort of quietly forced out the door and forced and maybe taking their case to court.
Well, it could be. I mean, nobody suggested that to me. I mean, to be fair, the figures that I've got go back to 2010, which I doubt would be... Well, I guess some universities are already doing that by then. I mean, there hasn't been a particularly marked upturn in the number of cases in more recent years. In fact, quite the opposite. 2013 was a bit lower than some of the others. Whether the ref's a factor, I doubt really.
Mm. But I mean, what does it suggest about? I mean, the lawyer that you spoke to, the partner, who said that it was higher than other sectors. What are we to read into this? That universities are creating situations where they are required to spend more on settling cases in employment than elsewhere, and that's surely an unnecessary cost. Well, a necessary cost for the cases, but unnecessary in the amounts.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, he suggested that cases involving universities are often particularly complicated because they involve all kinds of often discrimination claims as well. Mm. And the other point he made is that a lot of the cases are not sort of straightforward unfair dismissal cases. They often happen while that person is still employed, and the resolution is often that person resigns in exchange for a significant lump sum, and that's where those large figures are coming from. Mm. By the way, in case anyone's wondering, I should tell them that Imperial College actually isn't among the top 10 for payouts, but it did come in at number 11, and it is second for spending on lawyers. So clearly those employment tribunals didn't come cheap. They spent nearly 1.4 million over 4 years on lawyers' fees.
Absolutely. Well, Paul's story, which is on page 6 and 7, so a very large splash, has a lot of interesting figures in there, some which I imagine our readers and listeners will choke into their tea at reading, depending on what institution they're from, but thoroughly recommend checking it out. Now, our main feature of the current magazine. Jack, you wrote this. This is about London and how it is progressing quite rapidly to be to almost, as I said before, otherworldly status in the UK higher education. Why is that? What is it about London that is making it seriously popular for universities from around the country?
Well, I think the key thing is that it's very international, and this is really one of the major things. And it means that London universities are drawing in a lot more international students, far more than anywhere else in the country. They're drawing in international universities are setting up in London. Not only that, big regional universities are trying to establish an outpost in London to attract these international students. So I was looking at five different trends that were going on in London that perhaps weren't happening elsewhere in the UK. I think it's quite interesting because when we had the big row over fees in 2012, there was a feeling that with the different tuition fee models in England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, all those four nations would sort of drift apart in terms of the different policies. But actually, if anything, it's London, which has been this sort of like fifth nation, which has sort of drifted away from all of those and established itself as its own sort of ecosystem. So it's quite interesting how London is now sort of almost pulling away in terms of international students, research funding, also social mobility and widening access, the number of poor students and the university participation rates. All these things, it's very, very different.
Absolutely. I mean, your feature shows just the number of institutions it has in the capital, I mean, 40 alone. And then, as you say, regional universities and international universities have representation in London. But along with this, you know, the different aspects that you mentioned about the lure of the big city, it's a capital city, has a lot of potential economic potential and social mobility, purely, you know, because a lot of people are coming to London, and it's it's got a great status for that. It also, along with that, has coupled some you know challenges that go with these that other areas won't necessarily be.
Yeah, well, I think the cost of living is definitely the main one there.
Mm.
I mean, I spoke to one student union president. She was saying that one of her students is actually commuting from Europe each week because it's actually cheaper to do that for the two or three days that the student was having lectures than to take up a room full time in London. So it's just. I mean, it's just crazy that the house prices and the rent prices in London. And if you're a student, then it's quite tough, really. So that's one big pressure. But there's lots of other things like the competition. I mean, as you say, 40 institutions plus all those other British universities setting up branch campuses in the city. It's quite amazing how London has become this centre for so much of the ambitions of Britain's universities.
Mm. There seems to be forgive me if I'm wrong, there seems to be a disconnect between some of the opinions, obviously the opinions of the universities that are setting up branch campuses. They're going to be very positive about this. There are a few politicians, or previous politicians you mentioned, have kind of been a bit more cautious about the expansion of London. Is it that a binary divide? Is the UK HE sector more receptive to London's growing and policymakers?
Well, if you look at it sort of on face value, you wouldn't think that London is the place to have thousands and thousands of student space because it's just so expensive and things aren't really set up around them. In fact, their student satisfaction scores are very low. So, in a sense, students could have a much better time and have better facilities elsewhere, but they all want to come to London anyway, and the lure of the big city is still there. So, I mean, it is interesting. I don't know whether it will become a bit of a bubble, and then will the London bubble burst on HE? I suppose that's another story down the track.
Mm,
yeah. But,
if London's considered the dark star of the British economy, which is the current phrase, is London HE the dark star of the higher education sector? In other words, having a negative impact not only on the people in London, but the sector elsewhere, sucking the energy out of the provinces.
Well, that's the big debate. I mean, is London an engine for growth that benefits the rest of the country, or does it suck the life out of the UK? I mean,
does it really matter if there are 40 universities here attracting high fee paying overseas students? Are they not people who perhaps wouldn't want to go to the University of South Wales campus anyway? They're well-to-do overseas students who fancy officially studying but mostly enjoying time in London.
Like you say, maybe it's not a zero-sum game, but you have to think of all the time and money and attention that's being lavished on these London enterprises, and you maybe think maybe that investment could be put into turning your local university into a destination in itself. So, and that has been done. Students go to Leeds, Manchester, Liverpool. All these big cities, and they don't necessarily have to all be based in London.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jack's feature has a lot more than the stuff that we've just been discussing. Some intriguing stats and insight into London's enduring and burgeoning status in the HE world, for better or worse, we don't know yet. Karen, I get to say this again, the drunken monkey... Why We Drink and Abuse Alcohol is our book of the week. And
I think it's only fair that I should have been able to say the title.
Oh, sorry.
As books editor, you already got in at the
Apologies.
Beginning. Apologies. But I'll start from the back of the section first. Loads of good books, not just about animals and alcohol. Roger Morgan reviews Helen McCarthy's much talked about book, Women of the World, The Rise of the Female Diplomat, which obviously was something that 100 years ago was thought impossible because women would not be able to control unruly sailors. Who knew that this was the most important thing in a diplomat's job? Apparently so. Bill Perdue from the University of Northumbria reviews Travis Crosby's book, The Unknown Lloyd George. according to Bill, some of the salient points about Lloyd George's life remain unknown in this biography, mostly having to do with his promiscuity. And Graham Farmiloe reviews Nuclear Dawn, F.E. Smith and the Race for Atomic Weapons in World War II, a book about Franz Simon, who was one of the Brits who, according to Leslie Groves, the director of the Manhattan Project, contributed only minor bits to the development of the bomb. This book is another attempt to redress that oversight. Fred Ingalls reviews Ruth Barkan's Academic Life and Labor in the New University, Hope and Other Choices. Fred is a regular contributor who sees many reasons not to hold out hope. Ruth Barkan, I think, is also of that opinion, but there is a bit of light at the end of the tunnel. Norman Poser's book, Lord Mansfield, Justice in the Age of Reason, the eminent 18th century jurisprudence expert, scholar, lawyer, and judge, who's also perhaps better known now for being the uncle of a mixed-race young woman named Dido, who's the subject of a forthcoming film. We also have Cordula Van Wy on the Catholic Rubens, Saints and Martyrs. And yes, of course, as though no one has said the title before, The Drunken Monkey is our book of the week. Tiffany Taylor from the University of Reading reviews Robert Dudley's work about the nature of human attraction to alcohol, but also in the animal kingdom. Perhaps one of the most exciting facts that is raised in the review and in the book is that experimental data on fruit flies says that male flies deprived of opportunities to mate exhibited an increased preference for alcohol. This obviously bears out the earlier studies done on bar flies. Robert Dudley also mentions in the author profile, he is a scholar at University of California, Berkeley, and runs an animal biology laboratory there, that as acclaimed as Berkeley is, what you can mostly see at the University of California is decline of the American empire manifesting itself in diverse ways, including reduced state support for public infrastructure. And he says that the UC system is running now largely on historical inertia and unpredictable largesse from wealthy donors. He wouldn't recommend this outcome to other universities.
Wow. I mean, that's...
I'll just say the drunken ape would have been more biologically correct, although... not quite the same ring to it.
Not so much assonance there, I think. No. You know, you really, you know, but all of us have. In fact, Jack, you're the only person who hasn't said drunken monkey yet. If you'd like to.
Drunken monkey.
Thank you.
Sorry, I think, as you say, I think there's a big problem with drunken monkeys in Hong Kong. That I read once that they come into the city, climb through people's windows, drink their beer, and then fall out the windows again, and then go home again in the evening.
Interesting. Tiffany Taylor does mention, you know, some of the
inebriated baboons.
Robert's stories.
I had to get it in first. I knew you were going to say those words.
I actually wanted to say sozzle chimps because I quite like that expression. But she had never looked at it from her own field aspect of evolutionary biology, and it does have some interesting facts about. We often think that alcoholism is in humans is done from addictive personality. It's innate.
But in fact, it's an evolutionary advantage to seek out high concentrations of sugar. So when anyone complains you're down the pub, just say,
there we
it's
go.
Evolution.
Absolutely,
in
absolutely. Well, jam-packed podcast for you there. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for in this week's issue review. But if you want to comment on any of the content in the magazine, you can find us on all the social media platforms, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, and of course, the home, our website, timeshighereducation.co.uk. But until then, thank you, Karen, Jack and Paul. Goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.